This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yeis Wu-Heap. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
There's been a huge outcry across Italy about this death. The Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi, tweeted that the government stands with the town in the memory of Mr. Nambi and is opposed to hatred, racism and violence.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna describing the response to the murder of a Nigerian asylum seeker in Italy. The victim was beaten to death after responding to a verbal attack on his wife as they walked down the street of a small Italian town. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, India's prime minister has arrived in Mozambique, the first of four African countries he'll visit. And the African Union kicks off its 27th annual Heads of State Summit Sunday in Rwanda.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the murder of a Nigerian asylum seeker in Italy has sparked outrage across the country, and Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi condemns the act. The attack occurred on Tuesday when 36-year-old Emmanuel Chidi Namdi and his wife were walking down a street in a small Italian town. Namdi responded to verbal attacks against his wife by a supporter of a local football club and was reportedly beaten with a road sign pole and left in a coma. He died from his injuries yesterday. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following the story. She describes the attack and also spoke with me about divisions that are occurring as a result of the influx of migrants into Italy.
Emmanuel Chidi Namdi, who was 36 years old, was walking down the street in a small town called Fermo in northern Italy with his wife Chinyuri. They had fled to Italy last year after surviving a violent attack on a church in Nigeria, apparently by the Islamic extremist group Boko Haram, and had also lost family members in that attack. So they fled to Italy. It seems that Mr. Namdi was stopped in the town by someone who is believed to be a right-wing supporter from the local football club. He called his wife a monkey. And when Mr. Namdi responded, it seems that a scuffle broke out and he was badly beaten and left in an irreversible coma before dying on Wednesday. And today a man has been arrested on suspicion of his murder.
So what has been the reaction from officials such as the Prime Minister?
There's been a huge outcry across Italy about this death. The Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi, tweeted that the government stands with the town in the memory of Mr. Namdi and is opposed to hatred, racism and violence. And the Interior Minister, Angelino Alfano, has taken the unusual step of travelling to Fermo, the town itself, to attend a public security committee meeting that's going on there today. Immigration has been a very divisive issue in this town. Local churches have really stepped up and welcomed migrants, and they have been targeted by four small bomb attacks in recent months, causing minor damage and no injuries. But that gives you an indication of just how tension is very high in this community of about 40,000 people. The town's mayor, Paolo Calcinaro, said in a statement, "This town is very welcoming and very open to integration," and that he himself feels like he's living in a nightmare. So that gives you some indication. But we've also seen some odd reactions from other politicians, mostly condemning what they consider to be xenophobia and racism. But Matteo Salvini, the head of the Anti-Immigrant Northern League, while condemning the murder on his Facebook page, said it was a sign that illegal immigration was out of control in Italy. And he said it showed that controls, limits, and rules really needed to be put in place to stop what he considers to be this wave of illegal immigration.
The person that was arrested, has he been formally charged with the murder?
Not yet. We're waiting to see what transpires there. But the outpouring of sympathy for Mr. Namdi and his wife has been significant. And it's worth remembering, too, that this couple made a very dangerous journey across the Mediterranean to arrive in Italy after escaping the Boko Haram attack in Nigeria. They travelled through Libya on a boat across the Mediterranean. And Chinyere apparently had a miscarriage during this perilous journey, lost a child. So it's really been a very tragic story for this couple. And the local priest was saying today he's very concerned about Chinyere and how she's going to survive without her husband, having no family here in Italy.
I understand there's some other developments that have been going on there as well. Can you tell us about those?
Yes, we have two encampments that are causing major debate in Italy at the moment. Around 400 migrants camped and sleeping on the streets in Tiburtina, a suburb of Rome, and around 250 migrants are also camped in the small town of Ventimiglia on the border of France in the north of Italy. Both these situations have provoked a huge outcry from Catholic organisations and non-profit groups who are assisting the migrants, saying there is a need for urgent government attention to help these people who are struggling because of the huge demand. There's particular concern in Rome because these people need medical care, they need clothing, they need sanitation facilities. We're waiting to see what will transpire with that particular situation in Rome. But today, the Catholic charity Caritas were calling for urgent assistance in Ventimiglia, saying that the numbers were increasing and around 800 immigrants showed up for breakfast just yesterday in that town of Ventimiglia. So a lot of pressure there, a lot of demand, and no sign of these migrants moving because the border situation has become far more controlled and there's far more monitoring preventing these migrants from travelling into France and other countries.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
The European Union is beefing up its border control agency known as Frontex and is giving it a new name. It will now be known as the European Border and Coast Guard Agency. The EU Parliament has given final approval to the plan that supporters call a first step towards integrating border management for 28 member countries. On the other hand, critics say the new agency shows no respect for human rights. They call it a deportation agency that will send migrants and refugees back to bombs and starvation. More than 1 million refugees and migrants entered Europe last year. Nearly 230,000 have entered so far this year. About 3,000 have died or gone missing on the Mediterranean while crossing from North Africa. The new agency will have a rapid reaction pool of 1,500 border guards at the disposal of any member state.
Well, it's been more than 3 months since the European Union launched its controversial agreement with Turkey to reduce the flow of asylum seekers into Europe. Observers say that the agreement now appears to be on the verge of unraveling. Nuria Tason reports from Istanbul.
The deal between the European Union and Turkey has been under pressure on several fronts since it was signed in March. The target date for the start of the sending migrants back to Turkey was April 4. Since then, only small numbers have been returned from Greece. They include 462 migrants who did not apply for asylum or who voluntarily revoked their asylum applications. That number includes 31 Syrians and a few others from Congo, Somalia and Ivory Coast. The agreement stipulates that all asylum seekers and irregular migrants be returned to Turkey. For every Syrian returned to Turkey, one will be repatriated and given asylum in the EU. Any Syrian not granted asylum in Europe will be kept in a Turkish detention camps. Large numbers of Eritreans and others are also fleeing war and conflict. For them, the possibility remains high that Turkey will deport them. But even before any mass returns have occurred, there are rising concerns that the agreement could fail. Ahmet İçtuğgu is the director of the Migration Research Center in Istanbul.
Both sides having some political difficulties in their political will, both our European side and the Turkish side, because the European side shows some reluctancy towards the giving free visa regime to Turks. Also, there are some concerns about, I think, the political developments in Turkey.
Turkey demands visa liberalization for its citizens, but the EU is hesitant. Europe wants Turkey to end its crackdown on journalists and academics. Ankara refuses. İçtuğu says these issues are increasing the tension between two powers who, he says, need each other.
There is need for the collaboration between EU and Turkey, because without a cooperation between Turkey and the EU and even the other countries, I don't think the Turkey or the World Committee can deal with the refugee issue. So in that sense, the intention is good. This type of international issues becoming difficult without the Turkish collaboration. Recently, what we see that the particularly Merkel and the, even the other European leaders, they are very much focused with the Syrian refugee issues rather than the political developments in Turkey.
European human rights activists say conditions are worsening in Turkey. Last Monday, a Turkish court placed two Turkish journalists, including a local representative of Reporters Without Borders and an academic, under pretrial arrest for allegedly disseminating terrorist propaganda. Ankara insists it needs the laws to protect itself from terrorists, especially Kurdish fighters that have committed several bomb attacks in recent months, but the government is showing no willingness to accept criticism. İçtuğu considers this could harm the image of Turkey in European countries.
They are not so keen to give this free visa regime to Turkish citizens. If Europeans are negative about the free visa regime, I think the Turkish part will be reluctant in the operation of the readmission agreement, at least. Maybe on paper they will not say anything, but in the operation of the readmission agreement, I think that they will be not careful. So there's a risk really in the operation of the whole agreement. This is something negative for the dynamics in Turkey, of course. I mean, if Turkey loses the EU anchor, EU link, this will affect what direction the Turkish politics, the Turkish domestic politics will go.
For the moment, both sides seem to be interested in maintaining the agreement. But for how long? The European Union's top envoy to Turkey has just resigned after displaying what Turkey's minister says was disrespect for national values and for President Tayyip Erdogan. The resignation of the EU representative is a further sign of strained ties as Brussels tries to keep on track the landmark deal aimed at curbing the flow of migrants to Europe. For Voice of America, I'm Nuria Tesson in Istanbul.
Twelve Libyan soldiers allied to General Khalifa Haftar, the commander of the country's eastern government, have been killed by a car bomb in the city of Benghazi. It is not clear if the car bomb attack was orchestrated by Islamic State, also known as ISIS. The Eastern government is a rival to a UN-backed government of national accord led by Fayez al-Sarraj, based in Tripoli. In recent congressional testimony, President Obama's nominee to command U.S. forces in Africa, General Thomas Walhauser, called for more ground troops to fight ISIS. Michael O'Hanlon is a military expert at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Our senior Middle East reporter, Mohammed El-Shenawi, asked him about General Walhauser's comments.
Well, I think that the general, in one sense, was perhaps being modest, because what he's, I think, saying is that he doesn't see a strategy that we have that's got a good chance of working. We essentially do have elements of a strategy, but it depends on this coalition or national unity government coming together and really cooperating internally. And, of course, that's been our hope for a while, that we'd see Libyans collaborate and cooperate. And 5 years later, it hasn't really worked. And meanwhile, we're not offering them enough incentives, positive or negative, to really create that cooperation. So in theory, we're hoping for this national unity government to come together and then ultimately to be prepared to accept various kinds of aid, including security assistance, and then gradually extend its reach and its control. But the problem is that theory isn't really consistent with the last 5 years of history. and it takes a lot of wishful thinking to believe it's going to work now. So I think that's what the general's getting at when he acknowledges that our strategy really isn't working. I think I would say the strategy is not working, rather than to say there is no strategy at all.
But Pentagon spokesperson Peter Cook said that the U.S. is prepared to strike ISIS in Libya, but Libyan forces are already showing progress. Is that enough?
No, I don't know that it's enough. I think that we need to be realistic, as the general just was before Congress, and say that our hopes for a unified and effective Libyan fighting force to stabilize the country, to defeat ISIS, to get Libya back on its feet, those hopes need to be realistic and need to be modest. And therefore, I think that we probably need to be involved at a greater level in a number of areas, including helping fight ISIS directly, also helping train and equip whatever Libyan government forces might emerge to be able to do so better themselves, rather than just to sort of hope this is on a good path. I don't think it's on a good path yet.
So what's the best combination needed to be done by the U.S. to help Libyans uproot ISIS?
Well, I think the combination is some direct action, drone strikes, maybe even commando raids, other kinds of direct action against these forces by American and NATO and other outside air power or special forces, combined with a willingness to get on the ground and provide security assistance in the form of training and equipment to those Libyan national unity forces that may be willing to work with us. And then perhaps also some willingness to provide a degree of economic assistance so Libya can really start to get back on its feet. That shouldn't be needed for very long because of Libya's oil and gas, but that may be one more incentive that's important to add to the mix. And so I think those are the key elements that I could see, along with the ongoing diplomacy. And, you know, the diplomacy, let's hope, is going to get us to a greater sense of a national unity coalition. But I'm not going to be overly optimistic about that.
That was military expert Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. India's prime minister has arrived in Mozambique, the first of four African countries he'll visit. Narendra Modi begins his tour as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ends his own African trip in Ethiopia. Mr. Modi says he is looking for agreements on direct commercial flights to Maputo, as well as talks on trade, investment, security, and natural gas. His travel schedule also includes stops in South Africa and Kenya, which have large populations of expatriate Indians, and in Tanzania. Meanwhile, Mr. Netanyahu held talks today with the Ethiopian Prime Minister in Addis Ababa. That's his last stop after visiting Kenya, Uganda, and Rwanda. While China has heavily invested in Africa for several years, this is the first time in decades that Indian or Israeli heads of state have been to an African country.
The African Union kicks off its 27th annual Heads of State Summit Sunday in Rwanda. The most anticipated item on the agenda may be the election of a new chairperson. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
As African heads of state meet amid the rolling hills of Kigali, the biggest item on the agenda will be the selection of the next AU Commission chairperson, the successor to Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma of South Africa. Zuma will be stepping down after holding the position for the last 4 years. Alyssa Jobson is the advisor on African Union relations for the International Crisis Group.
I think it's important to stress that who leads the African Union Commission matters, and it matters immensely. The chairperson is responsible for shaping the continent's economic, political, and security agendas. And so it's really key that they have the best candidate possible in this job.
There are three candidates. Two are current foreign ministers, one from Botswana and the other from Equatorial Guinea. The third candidate is Uganda's former vice president and a former UN special envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. But J. Peter Pham, the director of the Washington-based Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, cautions that Dlamini Zuma's successor may not come out of this summit, since a two-thirds majority vote is required.
This time around, with three relatively unknown candidates, it might well be the case that two-thirds majority is not achieved, and there's additional campaigning and the possibility that other candidates might throw their hats in the ring.
But the leadership turnover doesn't stop there. A new deputy chairperson and eight commissioners of the AU will also be selected, according to Monde Moyangwa, director of the Africa program at the Wilson Center.
So you have a huge leadership transition occurring at the African Union. And so this is really going to determine which way does the African Union go.
The 54-nation bloc will be issuing its first e-passports, which will go to AU heads of state, permanent representatives of these states, and ministers of foreign affairs as part of a pilot program. The goal of the new passport is to ease restrictions in the movements of people, goods, and services across national lines.
Which is a step, at least symbolically, in the direction of a closer union, a Pan-African identity. But the reality is that despite those aspirations and those ambitions, it's not the want of passports that causes Africans not to travel to each other's countries and to trade and do business with each other. It's the lack of transportation infrastructure that makes that. A passport won't do you any good if you don't have a road that will get you from one place to another, or you don't have customs officials and customs clearinghouses to expedite the passage of goods.
Moyangwa expresses a bit more optimism.
I have been encouraged by the discussion on the benefits of this e-passport at the highest levels in Africa. So hopefully this is something that you're going to get more and more countries signing up to and hopefully becoming a reality in the next few years.
Back in January, an AU ministerial committee was asked to draw up a strategy on the International Criminal Court, giving special consideration to whether AU member countries should leave. The committee said that in order to prevent an African withdrawal from the court, the ICC should grant immunity from prosecution to sitting heads of state and other senior officials. That demand is at odds with many human rights activists, who say it would undermine the effectiveness of the court. Elise Kepler is the associate director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch.
Now, whether or not the conclusions and assessments of that committee are going to be considered at this AU summit is not clear, although it's important to note that we have seen again and again in the past few years that the issue of the ICC and AU attacks on the ICC regularly comes up very last minute, sometimes on the floor of the debate at the African Union summit. So, you know, really, we don't know for sure now, but anything is possible.
FOM doesn't believe the ICC issue will become a priority at this particular summit because no sitting head of state other than President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan is under threat, although he says in the long term the issue will be important.
In many respects, the collapse of the ICC case against the president of Kenya in a way took a bit of the urgency out of the African threat to withdraw from the ICC.
South Sudan will likely be discussed. HRW's Kepler says the AU was tasked in the 2015 peace agreement to establish a hybrid court to prosecute crimes committed during the conflict because the country is not a part of the ICC.
And we've been looking to the African Union Commission to get this process off the ground. I think a great outcome from the summit would be to see that there is encouragement for more progress.
Last month, South Sudan's leadership called on the international community to reconsider setting up that tribunal in an op-ed published in the New York Times. The AU summit opens July 10th and culminates with the heads of state meeting on the 17th and 18th. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Suleiman Terawali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
America.